Chapter 1. His hand pushed through the thick clot of dark blood on the window, smearing it rather than clearing it, spreading the congealed liquid across the windscreen in wide, palm-sized streaks. Glaring through the crimson haze, Jackson Block looked 15,000 feet down at the rising tops of the Boston skyscrapers, growing closer with every passing second.
"Remember the crop duster. Remember the crop duster,"
he hissed as he wrapped his hands around the yoke, the polymer sweat slicked and slippery, threatening to spring free from his grip. Even inside the canopy of the small Cessna 402, Jackson could almost feel the wind thrashing around him as sky and clouds screamed past, blurring into mixed colors, like a child slamming their fist into paints and swiping. Almost like the red-streaked handprint on the windscreen. His eyes kept drifting to it. That thick clot of wet blood, the congealed mass that had once been part of the pilot's lung. He could hear his father's voice in the recesses of his mind, that smoky, gravel-filled voice that sounded like rocks wrapped in wet cotton. Smoking a pack and a half a day for 30 years, he'd been the most powerful man Jackson had ever known, right up until lung cancer ravaged his body and pulled him, clawing and screaming, from this world into the next. He snapped his head in both directions, clearing the vague memory from his mind, focusing his vision on the sight ahead as much as he didn't want to. Jackson could see the tops of the tall buildings like square fingers reaching up to grasp him, to gently cradle the plane and help it to the ground. But that wasn't what they were, and in that one brief moment, Jackson suspected that in about 5 minutes he'd be repeating his father's dramatic exit from this mortal plane. At least nobody would be around to hear him, unlike the audience his father had gathered during his last seconds on Earth.
"Seriously?"
Jackson whispered to himself as he pushed his hands down his slacks to dry the sweat and blood. "Am I really picking now to deal with my daddy issues? More important stuff going on at the moment, Block." Settled into the co-pilot's seat, Jackson looked to his left at the pilot who sat slumped over, his shoulder harness the only thing keeping him locked in place. There was no movement in his chest, no sign of life. Thick streams of crimson caked his chin and soaked into his light beard. Jackson looked at where the pilot's legs were under the console, and he knew he had to clear the pedals, so he reached over the center sticks and hooked his fingers under the seat latch, shoving the seat back hard, to make sure the pedals were free on the pilot's side. Looking back over at his own console, he had access to all of the necessary controls from the co-pilot's seat, and he hooked his harness back in, drew in a deep breath, and clasped his fingers around the sticks. A hard crosswind struck the small plane in the left front side, shifting the entire aircraft to the right, and Jackson tensed his muscles, white-knuckling the yoke, his eyes moving down to the instrument panel. Altitude was dropping as he eased the yoke back, trying to maintain some kind of control over the aircraft. Even so, it pitched lightly to the right, the buildings below him disappearing from view underneath and to the left of the new direction of the aircraft, the sun beating down through one of the side windows from above. As Jackson eased the Cessna back level, a vast shadow blanketed the cockpit in momentary darkness, and he glanced over through the pilot's side window and sucked in a swift breath. A full-size 737 airliner was passing just above him, cutting a path between him and the sun, nose down and angled, flying far too low, far too quickly, and coming in well short of Logan Airport.
"Oh no,"
Jackson whispered as he watched, his mind barely able to process the horrific event he was seeing. Shrill warning warbles echoed in the cockpit and lights flared red across the instrument panel, warning of his attitude and his altitude, so he snapped his head away, trying to focus back on his own problems. Outside of the front windscreen, he saw the large plane continue its fateful plummet, hurtling down toward the busy city below, the inevitability of what he was watching gripping him like invisible fingers. Hanscom Field was northwest of the city itself, and he slowly guided the smaller plane in that direction, desperately trying to keep its nose up as the buildings below grew larger and closer with each passing second. Severe winds battered the Cessna from both sides, knocking it back and forth, but Jackson tightened his grip much like his heart tightened in his chest, and continued manhandling the aircraft, trying to force it level and straight. He couldn't help himself. He glanced out of the side window despite his wish not to see what was going to happen, and looked just in time to see the 737's left wing slam into one of the tall Boston buildings. The skyscraper blasted apart, disintegrating on one side as the wing hacked through it like a dull machete. Underneath the wing, the engine sparked and caught fire, flames racing up the surface of the metal, igniting the fuel tanks. Within seconds, the entire massive aircraft was engulfed in a wild, raging ball of white-hot fire, the plane tumbling down into the thick of the clustered city. Jackson looked away as he heard the massive, thundering explosion several seconds later, narrowing his tunnel vision to the northwest and trying not to think of what had happened down in the city just a moment before. What exactly had happened down in the city? He'd seen his own pilot, the kindly old gentleman coughing up half a lung of blood before slumping dead in his chair. Did the same thing happen with the pilot of the 737? If so, how? Why? Focus, Block. Focus! He shouted to himself as buildings ahead rushed toward him at odd angles, the plane digging lower than he felt comfortable with. Another downdraft shot up over the nearby buildings and buried itself in the nose of the plane, driving it sharply downward, and Jackson planted his feet, hauling back on the sticks, desperate to keep the aircraft level. The buildings were no longer obscure shapes 10,000 feet below, but were now very real, rising up to meet him. Yanking the stick left, he swept around the upper levels of a glass and concrete structure, lifting the nose enough to rise clear of another.
Just like riding a bike, right? He asked no one in particular. Except the bike isn't soaring through the air.
In the back of his mind, he tried to picture flying the old crop duster. The old Piper PA-36 was a world apart from the Cessna 402 he was guiding through downtown Boston now, but the concepts remained the same, and crop dusting required low-altitude evasive maneuvering. It was only too easy to get tangled up in power lines and other obstacles, and he remembered an especially close call with his father in the co-pilot seat, cursing him a blue streak when he almost clipped the phone lines leading to the house. Of course, clipping the phone lines wouldn't have potentially killed himself and thousands of people. He banked the Cessna left, skimming just to the side of another building. It seemed taller than he remembered. Then he quickly leveled out and shot forward, his map telling him that Hanscom Field was coming right up. His eyes scanning the console, he located the radio and a handy sticky note stuck just above it told him that the tower was on channel 118.5.
Hanscom Field, this is, I gotta be honest, I don't know who this is, but the pilot's had a medical emergency and I'm coming in hot and fast.
Acknowledged, a voice came back, remarkably calm given what they were saying.
We've got some major issues going on down here and at Logan, so come in at your own risk. Runway 29er is clear, though we have two more incoming flights that should be arriving shortly, if they're still in the air.
Jackson opened his mouth to ask a question but shuddered again, instead focusing his attention on easing the throttle and guiding the aircraft down. Up ahead he could see the vague shape of Hanscom emerging from the landscape, its familiar X marks the spot runway design immediately catching his eye. He'd flown out of and back to this field plenty of times in his short city career, though he'd never been the one landing the plane. He neared the surface, trees and smaller buildings growing larger and clearer, and suddenly something occurred to him. Glancing at the console, he remembered what he'd almost forgotten. To his left, he moved his hand and clasped it around a white lever, then pushed, his heart slamming as the retractable landing gear slowly swung out from the belly of the beast. That had never been a concern of his with the old Piper, but this Cessna was a different beast altogether. Distracted for a moment, he knew he was coming in too hard and too fast, and he peeled back on the sticks, trying to guide the plane into a more graceful downward slope. The runway filled his windscreen, and he glanced at it through the crimson smears streaking the glass, tensing his muscles as he prepared for the impact. The plane leveled and hit the surface with a thrash and jolt, his arms slamming along with the rubber on pavement, and an immediate squeal told him he'd made contact. Shuddering like a child out in the cold without their jacket, the plane angled left, but he adjusted, trying to straighten out. As he slowed the plane, he noticed for the first time a dark plume of smoke off toward the trees, a deep, dull, metallic gray, rising up toward the pale blue sky. As he got the aircraft on the ground and under control, the impact of what he'd seen in the air and what had just happened to him started to settle upon him like a heavy blanket, his shoulders slumping and his breath lodging in his throat. There was a dead man next to him, and likely thousands more on the streets of Boston, one of the worst disasters he was certain the city had ever seen. Little did Jackson Block know, the real disaster was only just beginning. A little over 100 miles away, Lisa Martin eased her old hatchback into one of the narrow parking spaces in downtown Aldrich, Connecticut. The very definition of a one-horse town, Aldrich had been where she'd lived her entire life. Well, nearly her entire life. Shutting the door as she exited the vehicle, she stood for a moment and appreciated the silence of this small slice of downtown, the main street lined with buildings on each side, but with car traffic sparse and foot traffic nearly non-existent at this time of day. She didn't typically work weekends, but when the library was in need, she always made sure to be available. Besides, even unexpected weekend work was still less stressful than the normal day-to-day she'd experienced in Boston while she'd been there for those few short months. Where her fiancé still was, grinding to ascend the mythical corporate ladder. She'd wished Jackson luck when she left, and she'd meant it. Lisa knew how important it was to him to be respected and valued for the hard work he put in, and while she herself doubted the validity of measuring yourself by your job, in this day and age it was easy to fall into that trap. Growing up on her parents' farm, Lisa was no stranger to hard work, but she was raised to work hard for the sake of working hard, not because you expected recognition or benefits. It was just what you did if you wanted to live. It hadn't been a stretch for her to transfer that work ethic to her current occupation, even if it was worlds away on the farm. Currently employed as a technical services engineer, Lisa was accustomed to being called at all hours of the day or night, especially as one of the only advanced engineers who lived anywhere close to Aldrich. The company she worked for was nearly 60 miles out of town, though she worked out of her home, well, her parents' home, and was nearly always on call for one customer or another. Today she wasn't on call, but rather than dispatch the on-call tech all the way to Aldrich, it made more sense for her to hop in the car and trek downtown to see if she could help. Opening the hatch of her car, she reached in and removed the canvas tool bag and slung it over her slender shoulder. It was heavy with several different tools that she rarely used, but she always brought it, just to be on the safe side. Technology had evolved to the point where very little had to be physically repaired, most things were just rip and replace, but Lisa didn't like to be left empty-handed.
"You need any help with that?"
the elderly librarian asked, stepping down the concrete steps onto the sidewalk. Lisa smiled. Yes, the tool bag was heavy, but she'd been an avid fitness buff for most of her adult life, right alongside Jackson the whole way, and there were a few tools that she was unable to lift and tote on her own.
"No, thank you, Mrs. Crane. I've got it covered, okay?"
Miss Crane nodded her narrow head and smiled warmly.
"Thank you so much, dear," she said as Lisa approached. "I know it's your day off. We just have a book signing this evening and the wireless isn't working. I don't understand what could be going on."
Lisa smiled right back. "Don't even worry about it, Miss Crane. Under control." She strode up the stairs smoothly, her legs moving in practice concert with her body. Along with the weightlifting, running, and CrossFit, she'd been attending the local mixed martial arts studio for several years, and felt like, for the first time, her body and mind were almost perfectly aligned with each other. As she reached the crest of the stairs, she couldn't help but think how strange it was she felt that way now, now that she'd left Boston and left her fiancé behind. She loved Jackson. She'd loved him for just about as long as she could remember, but coming back to Aldrich, leaving the chaotic insanity of the city, it had been like a cold splash of water that had fully awakened her to the importance of her home and her family. Her mother's illness certainly played a role in that as well. She walked through the front door of the old 19th century building, which had been renovated several times, but still had hints of the old school architecture, and followed Miss Crane to the wireless router, which was screwed to a thick wooden support beam. Lisa shook her head softly, quietly bemoaning how the gorgeous old support beam had been defaced by a blue and black metal and plastic box with dual antennas and blinking red lights. If the person who had built the library could see it now.
"I'm going to check downstairs, okay?" she asked. "This is one of the access points, but the controller is downstairs."
Miss Crane nodded. Lisa turned away and headed down the stairway, but a swift, sudden gasp grabbed her attention. It was a narrow, thin voice, a hushed shriek of surprise and dismay.
"Miss Crane?" she asked, whirling around. "Miss Crane?"
Suddenly, the library was dark and quiet. There was a murmured undercurrent of noise from something, though Lisa couldn't tell exactly what. Turning back around, she walked down the hallway toward the opened room where she'd left the elderly librarian. She saw it then, a television set perched on a table in the corner. She hadn't noticed it before. After all, it was always there, but usually it was dark. Today it was turned on, and she could see the city of Boston framed within its vintage, curved cathode ray tube. The buildings were immediately recognizable, except that they were surrounded by thick pillars of smoke and swarming with bright, yellow flame. Miss Crane turned toward her, face paling, fingers pressed to her chin.
I need to go, stammered Lisa. I need to go and check on Jackson.
Go, dear,
Miss Crane said in her frantic voice. Go, now! Lisa went, pushing her way through the front door and down the stairs, nearly running to her car, already pulling the cell phone out of her pocket, yet already suspecting that if things were really that bad in Boston, she may not even be able to get through. Jackson lifted the door toward the tail of the plane, then stepped down the extended ladder of the Cessna 402. He could smell the bitter twang of stale smoke in the late morning air. Everything around him smelled burned, as if he was walking into a room filled with ovens permeating a thick, rancid heat. As his foot hit the tarmac, he angled around the tail of the plane and could see pale smoke rising from the trees east of the airfield. A small, warbling fire truck cruised over the surface of the runway several meters away. The siren was shrill and tinny, the low roar of the truck hurtling over rough pavement tarmac almost louder than the horn itself as it barreled toward the trees. Behind him, Jackson heard the rapid thumping of falling footsteps, someone running up on his blind side. He whirled and looked at the person approaching, a skinny man with round glasses and a disheveled mop of dark, wet hair.
"What's going on out here?"
Jackson asked, narrowing his eyes toward the frantic-looking man.
"I was hoping you could tell me, man," the guy replied. "This place is a nightmare. Plane went down east of the runway over in the trees there. Radio chatter is through the roof. I hear something bad happened in the city."
Jackson nodded. "I saw it. 737 went down in downtown. Took the top half of Hancock with it. At least I think it was Hancock." The man pressed a palm to his sweat-streaked forehead.
"What the?"
"Your guess is as good as mine, bro." The man dropped his hand, looking toward the rising smoke, then back at Jackson again.
"You look familiar. You've flown in here before, right?"
Jackson nodded.
"Yeah, but as a passenger, first time as a pilot." "Yeah, right. That's Drew's plane, right? Where is he?"
Jackson looked back toward the aircraft, still not quite believing that he had been the one to land it. Even with his experience and the old Piper, the Cessna 402 looked like a much newer, larger, and fancier plane, one he had no business being behind the sticks on.
He died, he said quietly.
"What?"
"Mid-flight. Had a coughing fit, hacked half his lungs over the windshield, and just stopped breathing."
"Holy."
Jackson turned his hands over and looked at them. The dark skin on his left hand was still stained with a deep, dried streak of crimson. His eyes fixated on the color and held there, reminding him that not too long ago he'd put his hand in Drew's blood and smeared it across the window. With the sun beating down on the plane, they couldn't see the streaks from this angle, but he knew they were there. His stomach tightened deep inside of him, twisting like laundry being wrung out to dry. The man's eyes were wide as he took a cautious step backwards.
"I don't like this," he whispered. "I don't like any of this."
Jackson pulled out his cell phone and turned it on, fumbling with the touchscreen. He placed it to his ear but heard nothing. Pressing a quick series of buttons, he attempted to make a call, but just heard an automated voice reporting that circuits were busy.
"You got a phone in there I can borrow?"
Jackson asked, looking over at the skinny man. The man didn't reply. His eyes just widened further, and he turned to look at him more closely. He shook his head back and forth like he didn't understand what Jackson was saying.
"Buddy," Jackson repeated, "I need a phone. I gotta get a ride into the city."
"Into the city? You crazy?"
He took two steps backwards, then turned and took off, running at a full tilt back toward the tower, leaving Jackson standing in the tarmac just watching him grow smaller.
"What is going on?"
he asked the empty air. Hanscom Field stood just northwest of Hanscom Air Force Base in Bedford, Massachusetts, which was west of the city itself. It was the desired destination of many corporate flights, rather than dealing with the expensive runway rental and congestion of Logan Airport. Jackson's new job took him all over New England, and the chartered flight contract his company had with Andrew Graves had proven to be very useful indeed. Boston to New York was a hop and a skip, and even farther trips like his recent jaunt down to North Carolina were made far easier by the private charter. Flying throughout the Northeast was one of the things he liked best about this big city job. One of the only things he liked about it. The rest of the job he could do without, especially now. Especially since Lisa moved back home. Runway 29 ran east to west, just north of the Air Force Base, and with his inexperienced landing, he left himself a long walk down the paved surface toward the terminal. He began the trek, looking back over his shoulder a time or two, staring at the Cessna sitting on the runway while wondering what was going to happen to Drew's body inside. Thick smoke rose from the trees just beyond the Cessna, long fingers reaching up toward the blue sky. The silence sliced in ragged halves by the continued off-kilter scream of the fire truck sirens. A second truck had arrived, and it angled around the plane, moving toward the tree line where the other had been. A dangerous day for planes. Jackson wondered if it was an equally dangerous day for people in general. Cutting across the broad expanse of tarmac where the other planes sat, ready to be boarded, Jackson focused on the terminal far in the distance and picked up his pace. His small backpack was light on his shoulders. He'd only been gone the weekend, so he'd packed light. Lisa would never let him get out of the house with so few clothes, even for a two-night trip, but he didn't have to worry about that anymore. The thought hit him with a mixture of freedom and disappointment, a bizarre combination of emotions that he couldn't quite rationalize. What good was having such freedom if he had no one to share the freedom with? As much as he complained about how protective and overprepared she was, it had felt nice to have someone looking out for him, someone to take that tiny bit of responsibility away. Scattered buildings making up Hanscom's main terminal rose up ahead of him, and he moved left, heading towards Civil Air Terminal parking. He had no car here, he had no car at all, but his hope was that one of the taxi stations had a landline, or even better, an empty car waiting for him. Somehow he doubted that either of those things were true. Sweat beaded down his forehead as he walked, his cramped legs aching slightly with the shift from no leg room in the plane to aggressively walking across the long tarmac toward the terminal. Far in the distance there was a muffled thump, like the faint sound of a faraway July 4th grand finale. Jackson walked in silence, picking his way across the smooth concrete, growing nearer and nearer to the cluster of buildings ahead, angling toward the parking lot he knew was just south of the complex of terminals. As he walked, the doors from the terminal burst open, clanging out against the wall, and three figures dashed frantically across the parking lot. He thought he heard the faint echo of a scream from inside the building, but couldn't be sure. He saw crash bars on the inside of the door as they slowly eased closed, and he heard the distinctive latch of doors locking as they settled back in place. His stomach twisted at the sound, hoping that it hadn't meant what he thought it did. Moments later, he arrived at the street parallel to the terminal, but as he suspected, no cars awaited, and there were no phones available to call with. Even on the slowest days, there had always been at least a taxi, hired car, or some other vehicle out front and idling, but today there was absolutely no one in sight. Public payphones had become a thing of the past several years ago. Walking toward the terminal, he hooked his fingers on the front door handle and pulled, but found the door securely locked, as he feared it may have been. It was a small runway, and the terminal wasn't always staffed, and that certainly seemed to be the case today. On previous trips, there had always been a car waiting, or he'd use his cell phone to ring for an Uber, but today, neither was an option. He stood for a moment in the hot light of afternoon, swiping the shine of sweat from his forehead. Bedford was about 20 miles outside the city, and he needed to get back to his apartment. A long walk, to be sure, made even more treacherous by the vague and persistent threat that seemed to exist everywhere and nowhere all at once. Something was happening in the city. Something big, being carried by an oppressive, invisible force that grated against his very skin and slowly filled him with fear. A chill ran down his spine. A chill on a dozen little legs, leaving goose flesh in its wake. He turned and glanced over his shoulder, muscles tensed as if he was being watched, as if some vast and angry menace glared down upon him in judgment, ready to hammer the gavel of sinister punishment for some crime he didn't know he had committed. Sirens filled the air, and she could smell the faint whiff of smoke, but Amy Draper proceeded as normal throughout her routine, as much as she didn't want to. Driving through the city, even at this time of day, was a nightmare, and she had no real interest in visiting the in-laws. Her husband Kevin was away on business, and their normal ritual to his parents' house usually involved him driving. Amy had figured with him out of town, the weekly trip might be canceled, but no such luck, as her mother-in-law had called last night and asked when she and the kids would be over. She could have told her they weren't coming. As much as they annoyed her, Kevin's parents were nice people who cared very much for their grandchildren, cared to the point of overwhelming if Amy was honest with herself. Keeping the kids from their grandma and grandpa for 1 week certainly wouldn't change the world, but rather than put up with the passive-aggressive grief she'd get from Kevin and the guilt trip he'd no doubt get from his mother and father, Amy had decided to just buckle down and do it. It was only a few hours, and the drive would likely be the most frustrating part. Hey, maybe she could actually slip down to the coffee shop and have a quiet latte while the in-laws watch the kids? Silver linings and all that. Less than 20 minutes later, she'd coaxed the kids into the car, a 2-year-old BMW that came courtesy of Kevin's 6-figure salary. The salary giveth, and then as Kevin hurtled across the country on a plane, the salary taketh away. Mentally shutting out the quiet bickering of her two sons, Amy accelerated down the gradual slope of the driveway, once again noticing the stale stink of smoke in the air. Was something on fire? 50 miles west of Baltimore, the city of Frederick stood with a population of over 60,000 and the second largest incorporated city in Maryland. Nestled within the valleys of the Appalachian Mountain Range, the central Maryland city forms a corner of the Washington-Baltimore-Arlington triumvirate, though typically isn't as well known as the other three. The home of Fort Detrick, Frederick was at one point the home of the United States Biological Weapons Program, but as time evolved, it shifted its focus to research and defense against those same biological weapons. Detrick's 1,400-acre campus was unique, a collaboration between government units dedicated to defending against biological and genetic warfare by employing some of the most talented biologists and geneticists on the planet and developing an aggressive set of responses to such potential attacks. In the early 21st century, as a combined effort from the Army Medical Research and Material Command, the Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, the National Interagency Confederation for Biological Research and National Interagency Biodefense Campus, Fort Detrick developed Team 10, a state-of-the-art special operations unit designed to isolate and intercept next-generation biological weapons. Team 10 was constructed of men and women who were experts in their field, but also trained in the use of military tactics and weapons, hoping to create a team of soldiers who could not only identify the potential threats, but lead the strike team that would take down the rogue nations or organizations who threatened to use them. In the years since their development, while biological weapons remained a constant and aggressive threat, the soldiers on the team were slowly dispersed to other programs, working with intelligence agencies on early detection systems and espionage. Slowly but surely, the attention spent purely on biologic or genetic weapons faded. Since aggressive offensive tactics against the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and other foreign nations had increased, concern about a domestic attack decreased, and now Fort Detrick remained an important, yet sometimes overlooked, cornerstone of genetic research within the United States Army. Team 10 was still in existence and still remained a highly trained force of geneticists, biologists, and soldiers, but their funding had been greatly reduced, and they served more as a supplement to Army structure and not as their own individualized unit. The conference room was a wide, white room, relatively unremarkable, with a long, polished wood table and no less than a half dozen different whiteboards bolted across two separate walls. Joan Chabath stood in front of one of the boards in her dress greens, arms crossed behind her slender back, jet black hair pulled tight into a smooth ponytail. She peeled away one of her hands from behind her back and adjusted her narrow glasses, looking at the writing on the board, a hand-drawn web of connecting lines between different shapes containing names within. Shabbat had graduated from Georgetown with a degree in microbiology and never once thought she'd be standing in a conference room within a United States Army facility preparing to discuss international military operations. After graduation, she'd visited Johns Hopkins with a possibility of an after-school internship program in their medical research department, and that's where she'd met her husband. An Army brat since birth, Lance Shabbat had extolled the virtues of world travel, doing good work, and, most importantly, learning while you were doing it. 6 months later, Joan was enrolled in officer candidate school and beginning the long trek on her new career path. Here she stood. She was now Major Shabbat and the leader of Team 10, her husband 4 years dead after a routine visit to Southern Africa left him in the middle of an Ebola crisis. They'd tried to rush him home, but he died in one of the foreign lands he loved, thousands of miles from home and from his wife. As Joan looked at the whiteboard, she thought of him, as she always did, and thought of her last conversation with him, a static-filled Skype talk. She told him he looked pale, and he told her he was fine and he'd be home in a week. He died 48 hours later.
He died doing what he loved.
That's what they all used to tell her, back when she actually listened. She doubted he loved anything about coughing up his liquefied organs, lost in a third world country, but she allowed them their sentiments. They needed to rationalize how he'd died far more than she needed to. Joan had loved her husband, fully and deeply, but she was independent as well, and though she hadn't been interested in the Team 10 assignment, out of respect for her husband, she'd taken the duty. Now, 3 years later, in the midst of so much useless work, it felt like they finally had at least the genesis of a purpose. A goal they were aiming for. What she'd recognized most about her new place at the head of the table was the useless bureaucracy and the vast oceans of red tape and busy work. It had taken a full 18 months before she'd had a sniff of actual field work. Now they had a mission she'd been following since the very beginning and had actually started developing some targets. Broderick had done most of the heavy lifting, but her leadership and delegation of resources, not to mention the previously impossible collaboration with other government agencies, had drawn up a series of leads. However, with those leads came a considerable level of apprehension. There were some nasty people out there in the shadows experimenting with biological and genetic weapons, and the more light the team shone on them, the deeper into the shadows they seemed to scurry, like a floor full of cockroaches. "So, talk to me about Graybar," she said, turning to look at Sergeant Dean Davis, who was sitting on top of the table, a tablet clutched in his hands. When she mentioned the name, Davis scrolled through the rows of text, isolated an image, and pressed it with his finger. Shabbat looked back and he flipped the tablet around, showing her his face. The single word Graybar was written in one of the various circles on the board, several straight lines linking it to other shapes and names. Davis was one of the few non-scientists on the team, and it had taken some time to get him acclimated to the kind of work they were doing. Formerly of the Army Rangers, his specialty was military tactics, and he brought a macho, action movie, hero brutalism to their group of doctors and physicists. When it came to the field operations side of the house, Dean Davis was the man, and Shabbat defaulted to his perspective.
"Nationality unknown," Davis said. "We had a tail on him in Istanbul based on a tip from the CIA. We linked him to a European group of Islamist nationals who were thought to have been developing biological weapons. Some pretty revolutionary stuff."
"Revolutionary how?" Shabbat asked.
"Like next century revolutionary," said Zachariah Randolph, making his way around the table from the other side. "Ethnic bioweapon kind of revolutionary." Randolph was far more typical of the rest of the team, someone who had specialized in the sciences and had leveraged that knowledge to get linked to the research center, then begun his military training after the fact.
"Ethnic bioweapons are theoretical only," replied Shabbat, turning back toward the board.
"That's debatable," said Dalton Smith, coming around the other end of the table. "We've heard rumors of successful launches against Turkish insurgents as long as 2 decades ago."
"Not interested in rumors," Shabbat replied. "Plenty of real monsters under our bed to keep us up at night without worrying about the monsters that might be in our closet."
"Well, the field team was able to snag a laptop and got the hard drive partially decrypted before it zeroed itself out," said Randolph. "Some pretty convincing formularies."
"And what was the target?" asked Shabbat.
"Unknown,"
replied Smith. We didn't get the whole genome map on the laptop. But if the partial data that we can reconstruct it is accurate, we're on the verge of a whole new world. A very scary world.
Shabbeth turned back toward the board, crossing her arms. Rapid slamming came from the conference room door to her left, and she turned, narrowing her eyes to look through the small, rectangular window. She saw wide eyes and a frantic, strained expression filling the glass space, and waved the person inside.
"Sorry to interrupt," said Catherine Fielding, one of the Team 10 field agents. "We've got a bona fide red flag."
"Red flag?" Shabbeth asked, already taking a step toward her. Fielding nodded.
"Call came in about 5 minutes ago, from just south of Boston. Sounds like a localized outbreak."
"Just happened?" Shabbeth asked. Fielding shrugged.
"Unsure. The call was garbled and they didn't identify themselves."
"And we don't know who made the call?" Shabbeth asked, following Fielding from the conference room. As they exited, another man fell in from the hallway next to her.
"Negative," said Staff Sergeant Broderick Schmidt as he joined them both in their brisk walk back toward the command center. "Spoke with a heavy voice. Call was distorted. Sounded like there may have been signal issues."
Broderick Schmidt was arguably the brainchild of Team 10, though he'd never been the one in charge. Like Sergeant Davis, he'd joined the military first, in ROTC out of high school, using the GI Bill to pay for his college education at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and eventually getting a master's degree in molecular biology and genetics research. With a love for the structure of the United States military, he hadn't even considered a job in the private sector, instead moving right to Fort Detrick and jumping from department to department for a decade and a half before landing squarely in the middle of Team 10. Throughout his time at Detrick, he had been asked to lead the team three separate times, including after Joan's husband died, and he'd always declined, feeling like a leadership position would get too much administrative work in the way of his true love. He matched pace with Shabbeth, his neatly pressed dress greens moving in unison with hers. His receding arc of thick red hair drew far back on his balding forehead, and his mouth moved from within the equally thick rust-colored beard now streaked with gray.
"Are they still on the line?" asked Shabbeth, as they turned left down a neatly polished hallway.
"Negative," replied Schmidt. "Lost signal halfway through the call. We've tried to reach back out, but we're having a hard time getting through."
"To the caller?"
Schmidt's face grew deadly serious.
"To Boston."
Shabbeth stopped walking, her polished shoes squeaking on the smooth tile floor. She glanced over at Broderick.
"Excuse me?"
"The city of Boston has gone dark. As of about 2 hours ago, we've heard scattered reports of a plane crash in the middle of downtown."
"Good Lord," Shabbeth said.
She turned toward Fielding. "Go to communications. We've been isolated in that conference room, so start getting some intel. Figure out exactly what's going on in Boston." Fielding nodded curtly and vanished down the hallway.
"So what raised the red flag?"
"It was a child," replied Broderick.
"A child?"
"The entire market was filled with corpses, with the exception of a lone child. She'd been there with all the others, yet somehow whatever killed everyone else in the market skipped her."
"And you think it's because the weapon used was genetic in origin?"
Broderick shrugged.
"Too early to tell, but I thought the situation was urgent enough to warrant a closer look. Based on what else is going on in the city right now, I think we should be erring on the side of caution."
"I'm inclined to agree."
"So, what's our plan? Mobilize a team?"
Broderick squared his shoulders, preparing to launch into action. Shabbeth nodded.
"If something serious truly is happening in Boston, there may not be a team to mobilize. We may have to tackle this one ourselves. Grab everyone from Team 10 that you can. Tell them to meet us at the helipad in 15. I'm going to get clearance for a UH-60. Should have enough range to get us into the city. We'll suit up on the way."
"On it,"
Broderick replied and spun around, walking back toward the conference room. Shabbeth watched him go and wondered if things in Boston really were this bad. What could her small team of 8 do? Were they even moving quickly enough to implement quarantine procedures? Or was this all too little, too late? She didn't know, but she wasn't going to wait to find out. Angling down the left hallway, Joan Shabbeth made her way toward the colonel's quarters, already working out what she was going to say in her mind. The smoke was a thick, physical object,
tangling on his skin like fingers, clutching at his nostrils, trying to force its way down his throat. Jackson walked away from Hanscom Field, leaving the terminals and smoldering trees in the distance, keeping along the shoulder on Route 2A, which would lead him straight into the heart of the city, yet avoid the potential business of Route 2 itself, or, even worse, Interstate 95. It would be a long walk, somewhere around 15 miles, but Jackson was in good shape and thought that if he pushed it, he could make it in a few hours. Stiffness in his legs had eased as he moved, his frequent running and Tai Chi lessons loosening his working joints, though the backpack hanging off his shoulders added some weight and slowed his pace slightly. He was tempted to break into a run, to try and cut the time to the city in half, but every breath he drew was thick with a choking smoke, his nostrils and eyes stinging lightly, and he knew trying to run in this hot and smoky weather was asking for trouble. So far, Route 2A had been quiet, with only the occasional vehicle speeding by, most of them away from the city. He pressed his cell phone to his ear, hitting the redial button, and again the automated voice informed him that all circuits were busy and to try his call later. Lowering the phone, he looked off into the sky, thinking about Lisa, wondering what she was doing in Connecticut right now, if she was worried about him, or if she even knew what was going on. A plane crash deep in the heart of the city of Boston was certainly national news, but if he couldn't get through the cell towers, maybe all communications in and out of the city had been diverted. Was that even possible? What kind of disaster would have to take place to cut off all forms of communication? Didn't they build in all sorts of redundancies for this, especially after September 11th? Sirens warbled in the distance, shaking him from his momentary daze, and he looked down the stretching path of Route 2A. Two small vehicles emerged, grew larger, the volume of the sirens growing steadily louder and longer. They blared next to him as the two fire trucks passed, then faded behind them as they continued along, somewhere further west on 2A. Some strange, invisible destination. A place on fire. One of many places on fire, he was guessing, though they were a decent distance outside of the city at this point. Were the issues in Boston spreading out this far? Or was this something different? Every step he took, a new question formed in his mind, and as the smoke thickened and sky slowly shifted toward darkness, Jackson Block seemed to have far more questions than answers. TK Foods' main warehouse and distribution center sat just west of the city of Boston, an unremarkable structure of flat brown brick. Built for function over form, it was a large, spacious facility to handle storage and distribution of food products to a wide array of local grocery stores. Three large semis were parked out in the loading dock, an innocent, normal day in this building sitting on the crest between city and suburbia. Inside the facility, however, a siren wailed. Javier glanced both ways down the hall as he exited the warehouse facility itself, the doors to all of the administrative offices wide open, a flood of exiting bodies growing smaller to his left as they rushed toward the emergency exit. He'd been through his share of fire drills in his decade of working through TK Foods, and this wasn't that. It felt nothing like that, and even buried in the doldrums of the cold storage wing, he'd heard that dull, muffled roar coming from the east.
"What's going on out there, Javi?"
a voice asked, coming up behind him. Javier turned to see Maria and Jake making their way down the hall behind him. They were both day shift warehouse pickers with him, and he'd worked with Maria for the majority of his 10 years at TK.
"I got no clue," he replied.
"Something."
"Let's get out of here,"
Jake whispered.
"Everyone's leaving." "Doesn't sound any better out there than it is in here,"
Javier replied.
"Did you hear that boom?"
Jake and Maria both nodded. The rest of the warehouse had cleared out, leaving the space wide open, empty and deathly silent, a condition that was never seen this time of the morning.
"Everyone out!"
A hoarse voice barked from the other end of the hallway as Craig, the day shift security guard, emerged from the dim lighting.
"This ain't a drill, Javi. Let's go, okay?"
Javier nodded and withdrew from the hallway, Maria and Jake close behind. Lights pulsed on the wall and a shrill shriek warbled in the air, urging them to leave immediately, and they complied. The sun had been high and hot in the sky when Javier had arrived at work today, but as he exited out into the parking lot, he couldn't help but notice the overall dull gray shade. It was as if they were under particularly thick cloud cover,
the outside looking as if it were the evening instead of the height of mid-morning.
Yo, Javi, what's going on, man?
Javier turned and narrowed his eyes at the familiar faces of Gray and Porter, two other shift workers at the warehouse. Gray was dressed in torn blue jeans and a black t-shirt, while Porter wore stained cargo pants and a white tank top. They both typically worked the night shift, when the dress code was somewhat more lax, and they looked pretty out of place in the current surroundings.
Porter? Gray, what are you doing here?
Boss asked if we wanted to get some extra hours. We come in early and everyone's leaving. Fire drill?
Javier looked up into the cloudy sky, his eyes focusing on the haze just above. The way the sky was moving told him that it wasn't cloud cover he was looking at. It was a layer of thick smoke drifting from the east.
Not a drill, man, Javier replied. Don't you see that smoke, where it's coming from?
Gray looked up, then looked to his right, where the smoke drifted over the squat green trees.
Coming from the city, said Gray.
Didn't you hear?
Shouted Jake. He had wandered toward a different crowd of people huddled together outside the warehouse.
Hear what?
Gray asked, nodding at him. Jake walked over, keeping his voice low as if speaking the words aloud would somehow break some kind of strict confidentiality.
Plane crash, he said quietly. Right in downtown.
Holy, Gray said.
Jenny from HR heard there were two of them.
Javier and Gray exchanged nervous looks.
Two of them crashing doesn't sound like an accident,
hissed Gray.
Sounds like some bad mojo going down.
No kidding, Javier replied.
I don't know about you, but I'm not hanging around here. This is going to go sideways real quick.
Javier glanced up into the sky again. A dull ache gripped at the sides of his skull, cold fingers squeezing gently. The similarities to September 11th hit him quick and hard, a recollection that one couldn't help but make upon hearing of two planes crashing into the clutch of tall buildings in a major downtown East Coast city.
You think it's terrorists?
Javier asked as Gray started moving away. Porter was matching him step for step, Javier following along behind. Gray glared back at him as if he were crazy.
Ain't about terrorist, Javi. Never has been.
What do you mean?
Wait up,
Maria said, falling in line behind them and Jake next to her. They walked as a group, leaving the parking lot and angling down one of the side streets.
Terrorists. Bunch of bull,
Gray continued.
Just government cronies looking for an excuse. Inventing an excuse. Nah, Javier said, shaking his head. Bunch of conspiracy crap.
Gray glanced back at him and shrugged lightly.
Believe what you want, man. I've seen the proof, man. I've heard it from people who were in those towers.
Off in the distance, another muffled, thunderous blast shook the ground beneath their feet. Javier whirled around, eyes widening, and he could see a rising cloud of smoke and flame rolling up over the low roofs of nearby buildings.
What are we going to do?
Screamed Jake, looking at the fires, then looking back at Gray.
Where are we going?
I think they're pulling out the stops, Gray whispered. I guarantee you, by tonight, Boston will be under martial law. This is where it happens. Government moves in, lays down the law, exerts their power. They're creating another crisis.
So what do we do? Javier asked.
Do what you want,
Gray replied.
I plan on fighting back.
Javier and Maria glanced at each other as Porter, Gray, and Jake moved on down the sidewalk, striding at a brisk pace. In the air, smoke thickened, choking the breath in their lungs, and they turned back and continued in pursuit of their friends.